Today, it is a pleasure to have our poet-in-residence of the Hayden Institute and poet-in-residence at Queen's University in Charlotte, Kathy Smith Bowers.
Thank you, Bob. Good morning. Today, we are going to talk about the Epic of Gilgamesh. And I want to, first of all, share with you how I came to be introduced to this story. I started teaching at Queens in the fall of 1983, and in 1989, the president revamped the entire curriculum, got rid of all the distributive requirements, and created a four-year interdisciplinary core curriculum. And I was one of the teachers chosen to teach in this program. It was the hardest and the best thing I've ever done career-wise because it was like being a full-time teacher and a full-time student all at the same time. I wish you could have been a fly on the wall the day that I had to teach the Pythagorean theorem. I wrote it very neatly on the board, turned to my students, said, "Copy this down in your notebooks and don't ask me any questions." But that year, we also had as a text the Epic of Gilgamesh. I'd never heard of it before, but as I read it and went deeper and deeper into it with my students, I began to hear echoes of stories and characters and themes that I had heard before, that I had experienced before. And I felt this powerful story at a place in me older than my physical body. That's the only way that I can explain it. It seemed that this story was registering in me at the DNA level. It was the oldest story on earth. Gilgamesh is 1,000 years older than the Bible, 1,000 years older than the Iliad and the Odyssey, and it was my first encounter with the whole notion of archetypes. Now, you'll notice that some of my dear friends and colleagues say archetype. I prefer archetype because in my philosophy, if you can say something in three syllables instead of two, why not? Well, they say we teach what we need to learn. We teach what we need to learn. So as I came to be introduced to this whole notion of archetypes and sort of became obsessed with them, continued to do research, and of course once the universe brought me to Bob Hayden, which is one of the best things that ever happened to me in my life, I started learning more and more about this. And so one of the things that I found out is that Jung borrowed the word archetype from the Greek word archetypos, which means first of its kind. It is a word that means pattern or original image. So to me, Gilgamesh, we might say, is the archetype of all archetypes. That's not true anyway, because the true archetype is simply a pattern that's sort of existing out there in the universe. I think it what Plato would have called the ideal forms. First of all, this is a story that was not discovered until 1850. It was discovered on stone tablets written in cuneiform, and at that time, cuneiform had not even been deciphered. So it was found in 1850, and it wasn't translated until 1872. Now, the setting of this story is Uruk, which was an ancient city situated between the Tigris and Euphrates and its modern-day Iraq. And the setting of the story, this story happened at least as far back as 2750 before the Christian era. So that's at least how old it is. Now, I would like for my partners in crime to now come up and take their seats. Our first character, the protagonist, the hero of our story, is Gilgamesh. And Gilgamesh is the, yeah, there's my Utnapishtim. Get over here. Didn't show up for rehearsal. You probably won't even know when to come in, will you? Knowing him, he probably will. All right, Gilgamesh is our out-of-control king of Uruk. Gilgamesh is two-thirds divine and one-third human. He was actually the son of Ninsun, a goddess, and Lugalbanda, who was a man who became a god. So Gilgamesh was two-thirds divine and one-third human. His name means the old man is a young man. The old man is a young man. Because Gilgamesh, for so much a part of this story, is just fragmented, I got two characters to play Gilgamesh. We have Dick as our first Gilgamesh. Bill is going to be our later Gilgamesh. You will also hear the name Shamat, who is a priestess, harlot, prostitute at the Temple of Ishtar. It's interesting that the version that I'm using is the newest version that's out there by Stephen Mitchell. He calls it a version, not a translation. But in some of the earlier translations that I've used, Shamat was referred to as a harlot or a prostitute. But in ancient Sumeria, she was really a priestess. A priestess, and sexuality to the ancient Sumerians wasn't, they didn't look at it the same way that we do. These priestesses who were at the Temple of Ishtar, who was the goddess of sexuality and war, kind of makes sense. what they would do was they would offer themselves to any of the men, old, young, handsome, ugly, and anybody, they offered themselves to any of the men, and it was a divine act. It was an honoring of God and the goddess Ishtar. So you might want to think of Shamat in terms of a person who was doing a divine job there. She was a priestess of Ishtar. She's doing a divine job. In more ways than one. We have Enkidu. Ernie is our Enkidu, and a fine Enkidu he is. Enkidu was two-thirds animal and one-third man, and Ernie said that he just had his hair cut. He wished he had not had his hair cut. The name Enkidu means Lord of the Good Place or the Wild One. And then we have our Humbaba. Humbaba. Yes, good gene is our Humbaba. Humbaba is a monster who guards and protects the cedar forest. Of course, the scholars say that all of mythology begins in reality. So Humbaba, the scholars believe, was actually a volcano. Ishtar. Roberta, our goddess of sexual love and war. Yeah. And you will also hear the title, the Bull of Heaven, who was probably, in reality, an earthquake. And then finally, our Utnapishtim, Jeremy, who did not show up for rehearsal. And Utnapishtim was the only man in Gilgamesh to ever be granted immortal life by the god. So I think we chose our Utnapishtim well. So myths are really communal dreams. They're communal dreams. If you want to know the who, what, where, and when of a culture, read its history. But if you want to know about the dreams, the hopes, the fears, the aspirations of a culture, read their myths. It's the communal dreams of a culture. So I just want you to let this story wash over you. You can close your eyes if you like. You can lie down on the floor. And I would like to dedicate this reading of this, or partial reading, to Marsha Purvis, who for the last 40 years, and it hurts me to say that, has alternately been the Gilgamesh to my Enkidu or the Enkidu to my Gilgamesh. So, and I think if we're lucky, we all have someone like that. Okay. The prologue of Gilgamesh begins with an omniscient narrator. It is an invitation into the walled city of Uruk, to the copper box under the cornerstone marked with his name, Gilgamesh. It is an invitation to open and read how Gilgamesh suffered all and accomplished all. We are first introduced to Gilgamesh, the king of Uruk, two-thirds divine and one-third human, the son of the goddess Ninsun and Lugalbanda, a man who became a god. Gilgamesh had been designed by Aruru, mother of creation, to be the strongest of men, huge, handsome, radiant, perfect. He had become, however, out of control with what the ancient Greeks would later have called hubris or excessive pride. He does whatever, whenever he wants, oppressing and enslaving the young men, and whenever a bride is about to marry, it was decreed that she must first give herself to Gilgamesh. Everyone is appalled at his behavior. Fed up with their king. The people of Uruk cry out to the gods to help them, and the gods cry out in turn to Anu, father of all gods, begging him to do something. Anu hears their pleas and goes to Aruru, goddess of all creation, who created this magnificent man, Gilgamesh. And here is Anu's plea to Aruru. Aruru, you're the one who created humans. Now go and create a double for Gilgamesh, his second self, a man who equals his strength and courage, a man who equals his stormy heart. Create a new hero. Let them balance each other perfectly so that Uruk has peace once again. Aruru creates a counterpart, a sidekick, an equal companion to Gilgamesh. His name is Enkidu. She moistened her hands. She pinched off some clay. She threw it into the wilderness, kneaded it, shaped it to her idea, and fashioned a man, a warrior, a hero, Enkidu the brave, as powerful and fierce as the war god Ninurta. Hair covered his body. Hair grew thick on his head and hung down to his waist like a woman's hair. He roamed all over the wilderness, naked, far from the cities of men, ate grass with the gazelles, and when he was thirsty, he drank clear water from the water holes, kneeling beside the antelope and the deer. One day, a trapper sees this huge animal-like man and becomes terrified at his sight. He has never seen anything like this before in his life. He runs to his father and tells him what he has seen. "Father, I have seen a savage man at the waterhole. He must be the strongest man in the world, with muscles like rock. I have seen him outrun the swiftest animals. He lives among them, eats grass with gazelles, and when he is thirsty, he drinks clear water from the waterholes. I haven't approached him. I'm too afraid. He fills in the pits I have dug. He tears out the traps I have set. He frees the animals, and I can catch nothing. My livelihood is gone." The father's trapper sends him to King Gilgamesh. He will know what to do, and of course the god's plan is set into motion. Gilgamesh sends the trapper next to the temple of the goddess Ishtar. goddess of sexual love and war. He tells the trapper to find the priestess Shamat and to take her to this amazing man hanging out with the animals in the wilderness and to work her love arts on him. The trapper and the priestess Shamat travel for 3 days until they reach the water hole where the trapper had seen Enkidu drinking with the other animals. Shamat does as she has been instructed. She takes off her clothes and lies down on the ground and waits for Enkidu to approach her. The plan continues to go well, for Enkidu leaves the other animals at the watering hole and lies down with Shamat. And for 7 days, they make love until he has had enough. And I would like to add here, it is mentioned several times in this epic that Enkidu stays erect for the whole 7 days, which is how we know this is a myth. And not history. But this part absolutely breaks my heart because you remember Enkidu has been living with the animals. At last he stood up and walked toward the water hole to rejoin his animals. But the gazelles saw him and scattered. The antelope and deer bounded away. He tried to catch up, but his body was exhausted. His life force was spent. His knees trembled. He could no longer run like an animal as he had before. He turned back to Shamat, and as he walked, he knew that his mind had somehow grown larger. He knew things now that an animal cannot know. Enkidu returns to Shamat and she tells him to leave the other animals behind. He is beyond them now. She tells him about a king of Uruk who is out of control, tells him to go with her to the city of Gilgamesh and to begin living the life he deserves to live. In her description of Gilgamesh, she reveals things to Enkidu. Gilgamesh is a man who is destined for both joy and grief. He is so full of life force, so superior to the average human being, that he needs no sleep. She also tells him that Gilgamesh has already had a prophetic dream about Enkidu. Shamat and Enkidu travel to where a group of shepherds are living in their huts. The shepherds offer him human food, and Enkidu doesn't know what to do with it. Here is his second initiation into humanhood. The first one was his sexual encounter and experience with Shamat. Now he is being presented human food and he doesn't know what to do with it. But when he finally figures out what to do with the food, he eats a whole loaf of bread, then another, and then he drinks 7 pitchers of beer. He's a fast learner. This is the description after Enkidu learns how to eat this human food and drink this human drink. His heart grew light, his face glowed, and he sang out with joy. He had his hair cut, he washed, he rubbed sweet oil into his skin and became fully human. Shining, he looked handsome as a bridegroom. When the shepherds lay down, Enkidu went out with sword and spear. He chased off the lions and the wolves. All night he guarded the flocks. He stayed awake and guarded them while the shepherds slept. Enkidu leaves the shepherds and he travels until he eventually reaches the walled city of Uruk. Determined to challenge this arrogant king who oppresses the young men and has his way with the young virgins before their wedding night. It happens that a wedding is about to take place, so Gilgamesh heads toward the marriage house to enjoy the virgin du jour, but he finds Enkidu positioned before the door like a huge boulder. A fight ensues. And after testing each other's amazing strength and prowess, Gilgamesh subdues Enkidu, and then they embrace and kiss. They hold hands like brothers. They walk side by side. They become true friends. Now, as time passes and the two friends grow closer, Gilgamesh starts to get bored and decides the two of them should go on a journey to the cedar forest that is guarded by the fierce monster Humbaba. "We must kill him," Gilgamesh says, "and drive out evil from the world." Enkidu argues against this plan.
"Gilgamesh, how can any man dare to enter the cedar forest? It is sacred to Enlil. Hasn't he declared its entrance forbidden? Hasn't he put Humbaba there to terrify men? We must not go on this journey. We must not fight this creature. His breath spews fire. His voice booms like thunder. His jaws are death. He can hear all sounds in the forest, even the faintest rustling among the leaves. He will hear us 100 miles away. Who among men or gods could defeat him? Humbaba is the forest guardian. Enlil put him there to terrify men. Whoever enters will be struck down by fear."
But Gilgamesh disagrees with Enkidu.
"That is the courage you always have had. If I die in the forest on this great adventure, won't you be ashamed when people say Gilgamesh met a hero's death, battling the monster Humbaba? And where was Enkidu? He was safe, at home. You were raised in the mountains with your own hands. You have killed marauding lions and wolves. You are brave. Your heart has been tested in combat. But whether you come along or not, I will cut down the tree. I will kill Humbaba. I will make a lasting name for myself. I will stamp my fame on men's minds forever. I'll be back."
They're making this up, guys. Enkidu finally gives in, and off they go to the cedar forest to kill its fierce protector, Humbaba. The elders of the city advise Gilgamesh to let Enkidu go first. He knows the way to the cedar forest. He is tested in battle. He is brave and strong. He will guard you at every stage of the journey. And off they go, hand in hand. That's true. I'm not making that up. Hand in hand to the cedar forest to slay the monster Humbaba. Gilgamesh and Enkidu travel 1,000 miles in 3 days. 1,000 miles in 3 days. This is a 6-week journey for ordinary men. It is at this point that the series of dreams begins. Gilgamesh prays to the gods for a favorable dream, and Enkidu does a ritual to call up the dreams. He walks around Gilgamesh, where Gilgamesh is lying on the floor, and sprinkles flour around him. As Enkidu has become less animal and more human, Gilgamesh is becoming less god and more human. Remember, early in the story, we learned that one of the things about Gilgamesh is that he is so strong and so powerful and so almost divine that he doesn't even require sleep. But this is beginning to change. Each night, Gilgamesh has a dream, 5 in a row, each more horrible than the dream before. Dream 1, a huge mountain falls down on the two of them. Dream 2, another huge mountain. This time the mountain throws Gilgamesh down and pins him to the ground. Dream 3, the heavens roar and the earth heaves, then darkness, silence. Lightning flashes, igniting the trees. By the time the flames die out, the ground is covered with ash. Dream 4, Gilgamesh sees a fierce eagle with a lion's head. It floats down toward him like a huge cloud. It grimaces. Flames shoot out from its mouth. Then a young man with an unearthly glow seizes the creature and breaks its wings, wrings its neck, and throws it on the ground. Dream 5. Gilgamesh is wrestling with a gigantic bull. Its bellow shatters the ground and raises the clouds of dust that darken the sky. It pins him down and crushes him. Then a man pulls him up and puts his arms around him and gives him fresh water from his water skin. But each time, when he asks Enkidu to interpret the dream for him, Enkidu, no matter how horrendous the dream, says, I guess he says, if this were my dream, Gilgamesh. Don't worry, my friend. The dream you had is a favorable one. So finally, the two of them reach the edge of the cedar forest, and they can hear in the distance Humbaba's terrible roar. As they get closer and closer to Humbaba, Enkidu begins to tremble in fear. He doesn't want to proceed. He says he will return to Uruk, and everyone can see what a coward he is. He explains to Gilgamesh that Gilgamesh has never witnessed Humbaba as he once did, as he roamed in the wilderness with the other animals. But Gilgamesh will not hear of it. Forget about death, he says. Let your heart inspire you to be joyous in battle. Again, they proceed together. Finally, they encounter the fierce Humbaba, and here is how he greets them.
I know you, Gilgamesh. Don't be a fool. Go away. Leave the cedar forest. Have madmen told you to confront me here? I'll tear you limb from limb. I'll crush you and leave your bloody, mangled body on the ground. And you, Enkidu, you son of a fish, or a turtle, you gutless, fatherless pawn who never sucked on mother's milk. I saw you in the pastures when you were young. I saw you graze among the wandering herds. But I didn't kill you. You were too scrawny. You wouldn't have made a decent meal. And now you dare lead Gilgamesh here. You both stand before me looking like a pair of frightened girls. I'll slit your throats. I'll cut your heads off. I'll feed your stinking guts to the shrinking vultures and crows.
Ooh. Now it is Gilgamesh who is trembling in fear, too afraid to go on. And in turn, Enkidu tells him such behavior is unworthy of him. If you kill me, Humbaba says, you will call down the gods' wrath and their judgment will be severe. Enkidu says to Gilgamesh, quick, dear friend, don't hesitate to slaughter him. Slit his throat. Establish your fame so that forever men will speak of brave Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh, hearing his beloved friend, comes to himself. He yells. He lifts his massive axe. He swings it. It tears into Humbaba's neck. The blood shoots out. He topples like a cedar and crashes to the ground. At his death roar, the mountains of Lebanon shook. The valleys ran with his blood. For 10 miles, the forest resounded. Then the two friends sliced him up, pulled out his intestines, cut off his head with its knife-sharp teeth and horrible bloodshot staring eyes. Take that, Humbaba. But before Humbaba dies, he curses them both. Because you have done this, may Enkidu die. May he die in great pain. May Gilgamesh be inconsolable. May his merciless heart be crushed with grief. With Humbaba now dead, Gilgamesh and Enkidu trample into the cedar forest, cutting it to the ground as they go. They bind logs together and build a raft. Enkidu steers down the river as Gilgamesh carries Humbaba's head. When Gilgamesh returns to Uruk, he cleans himself up. He is beginning to look more and more like Enkidu, as Enki, sometimes I call him Enki, was beginning to look and act more like Gilgamesh. He puts on his crown, and when he does, the goddess Ishtar catches a glimpse of him.
Come here, Gilgamesh. Marry me. Give me your luscious fruits. Be my husband. Be my sweet man. I will give you abundance beyond your dreams, marble and alabaster, ivory and jade, gorgeous servants with blue-green eyes, a chariot of lapis lazuli with golden wheels and guide horns of amber. With golden wheels pulled by storm demons like giant mules. When you enter my temple and its cedar fragrance, high priests will bow down and kiss your feet. Kings and princes will kneel before you, bringing you tribute from east and west. And I will bless everything you own, your goats will bear triplets. Your ewes will twin. Your donkeys will be faster than any mule. Your chariot horses will win every race. Your oxen will be the envy of the world. These are the least of the gifts I will shower upon you. Come here. Be my sweet man. Or as we say today, be my hunka hunka burning love.
Ah, but Gilgamesh has begun to have some ethical standards by now. He begins to remind Ishtar of all the other men she has loved and then thrown away. Not only men, but he reminds her of her betrayal of the roller bird and the lion and the stallion. It seems that Ishtar is not picky about who she has relations with. Ishtar did not limit her love to only humans and gods. He tells her, if I too became your lover, you would treat me as cruelly as you treated them. Ishtar is furious at his rejection. She goes to Anu, father of the gods, and tells on Gilgamesh. She says, Father, Gilgamesh slandered me. He hurled the worst insults at me. He said horrible, unforgivable things. Then she asks Anu to give her the bull of heaven so she can send it to Gilgamesh and avenge her honor. Ishtar goes up into the skies and brings back the bull of heaven. Then she unleashes it on the city of Uruk. When the bull snorts, the earth cracks open, and 100 warriors fall into the earth. When the bull snorts a second time and a third time, Enkidu falls in. Then, as they say, all hell breaks loose. Here is a description of their killing of the bull of heaven. I guess their courage grew after slaying Humbaba. The whole land shook, the streams and marshes dried up, the Euphrates water level dropped by 10 feet. When the bull snorted, the earth cracked open, and 100 warriors fell in and died. It snorted again, the earth cracked open, and 200 warriors fell in and died. When it snorted a third time, the earth cracked open, and Enkidu fell in up to his waist. He jumped out and grabbed the bull's horns. It spat its slobber into his face. It lifted its tail and spewed dung all over him. Gilgamesh rushed in and shouted, Dear friend, keep fighting. Together, we are sure to win. Enkidu circled behind the bull, seized it by the tail, and set his foot on its haunch. Then Gilgamesh, skillfully, like a butcher, strode up and thrust his knife between its shoulders and the base of its horns. After they had killed the bull of heaven, they ripped out its heart and they offered it to Shamash. Then they both bowed before him and sat down like brothers, side by side. Ishtar, of course, is more furious than ever. She gathers her priestesses together, and they begin a solemn lament. That night, Enkidu has a horrible dream. He dreams that the gods held a meeting and decided that because Enkidu and Gilgamesh have killed Humbaba and slaughtered the bull of heaven, that one of them must die. It is also revealed to Enkidu in his dream that it will be he, not Gilgamesh, who will die. The next night he dreams that he is attacked by a horrible creature with a lion's head and an eagle's talons and wings. He cries out to Gilgamesh for help, but Gilgamesh is afraid and does not come to save him. Now something interesting happens. The tables turn. Gilgamesh uses Enkidu's strategy of dream interpretation. He says, Enkidu, if this were my dream... No, I'm just teasing. He says, well, you know, that sounds kind of bad, but these dreams may be good omens. The gods send dreams, and I love this, the gods send dreams only to the healthy, never to the weak. So it is a healthy man who has dreamed this. I think Gilgamesh might have taken the Hayden Institute dream course. Gilgamesh says he will pray to Anu, Enlil, and Ea to help Enkidu. He says, I will beg them to show you mercy. Then I will have a gold statue made in your image.
Gilgamesh, my friend, there is no gold statue that can cure this illness. But Enlil has decided cannot be changed. My fate is settled. There's nothing you can do. You have walked beside me, steadfast, through so many dangers. Remember me. Never forget what I have endured.
That day, Enkidu's strength begins to fail. Every day, he grows weaker. And when his dear friend Gilgamesh hears the death rattle, he moans like a dove. His face grows dark. Beloved, wait, don't leave me, he pleads with Enkidu. Dearest of men, don't die, don't let them take you from me. Gilgamesh weeps all night for his dying friend, begging him not to go.
O Enkidu, you were the axe at my side in which my arm trusted, the knife in my sheath, the shield I carried, my glorious robe, the wide belt around my loins. And now, a harsh fate has torn you from me forever. Beloved friend, swift stallion, wild deer, leopard ranging in the wilderness. Enkidu, my friend, swift stallion, wild deer, leopard ranging in the wilderness. Together we crossed the mountains. Together we slaughtered the bull of heaven. We killed Humbaba, who guarded the cedar forest. O Enkidu, what is this sleep that has seized you, that has darkened your face and stopped your breath?
But Enkidu does not answer. Gilgamesh touches his heart, but it does not beat. Gilgamesh, upon seeing the lifeless body of his beloved friend, prays to the gods and goddesses to walk by Enkidu's side in the underworld so his friend will not be sick at heart. After the funeral, Gilgamesh goes out from Uruk into the wilderness with matted hair and a lion's skin. Now Gilgamesh, who once boasted no fear of death, and of course who had yet to experience the death of an intimate friend or loved one, now begins to confront his own mortality. No longer is he that fearless hero who once spurred Enkidu on by laughing at his fear of death. Now Gilgamesh weeps and asks, must I die too? If only I could find the one man whom the gods made immortal, I could learn the secret. And so Gilgamesh now sets out alone in search of the one man who overcame death, Utnapishtim, who Gilgamesh says is his last hope. Gilgamesh is directed to enter the earth between the twin peaks, to go down into the tunnel into which the sun plunges every night. He follows instructions and, after much difficult traversing, comes to the Garden of the Gods just at the edge of the ocean, where he finally comes face to face with Utnapishtim, who asks Gilgamesh why he is so pale and haggard looking. Gilgamesh explains,
shouldn't my cheeks be hollow? Shouldn't my face be ravaged, frost-chilled and burnt by the desert sun? Shouldn't my heart be filled with grief? Shouldn't I be worn out and ready to collapse? My friend, my brother, whom I loved so dearly, who accompanied me through every danger. Enkidu, my brother, whom I loved so dearly, who accompanied me through every danger. The fate of mankind has overwhelmed him. For 6 days, I would not let him be buried, thinking, if my grief is violent enough, perhaps he will come back to life again. For 6 days and 7 nights, I mourned him, until a maggot fell out of his nose. Then I was frightened. I was terrified by death, and I set out to roam the wilderness. I cannot bear what happened to my friend. I cannot bear what happened to Enkidu. So I roam the wilderness in my grief.
Then Utnapishtim tells Gilgamesh the story of how he alone of men came to be immortal like the gods. Utnapishtim tells him that he too was once a great king long ago, when the gods decided to send a great flood to destroy the earth in order to punish the people for all their sins. But Utnapishtim learned of the plan through Ea, who instructed Utnapishtim to tear down his house and build a great ship. When all the work on the ship was finished, Utnapishtim gathered up the animals, his kinfolk, and all of the treasures that he wanted to save, and battened down the hatches. Now, Utnapishtim, tell us what happens next.
For 6 days and 7 nights, the storm demolished the earth. On the 7th day, the downpour stopped. The ocean grew calm. No land could be seen, just water on all sides, flat as a roof. There was no life at all. The human race had turned into clay. I opened the hatch, and the blessed sunlight streamed upon me. I fell to my knees and wept. When I got up and looked around, a coastline appeared half a mile away. On Mount Nimush, the ship ran aground. The mountain held it and would not release it. For 6 days and 7 nights, the mountain would not release it. On the 7th day, I brought out a dove and set it free. It flew off, and then it flew back to the ship because there was no place to land. I waited, and then I brought out a swallow and set it free. The swallow flew off and then flew back to the ship because there was no place to land. I waited, and then I brought out a raven and set it free. The raven flew off, and because the water had receded, it found a branch. It sat there. It ate. It flew off and did not return.
Utnapishtim then tells the boatman, "This is the last time you are allowed to cross the ocean and reach these shores." He tells his wife, "Bring Gilgamesh to the tub, clean him up, comb his hair." And when she does, and Gilgamesh emerges shining and clean and refreshed and resurrected, he puts on his crown, and he and the boatman head back. After 1,000 miles, Gilgamesh and the boatman arrive back in Uruk once more, and for the first time, finally home. And for the rest of his days, until he is an old man, Gilgamesh will rule Uruk with the dignity and spirit of the great king he has endured so much to become, a name that will end up in a copper box under the cornerstone of the great walled city of Uruk, a box that invites each of us to open so that we too can read of Gilgamesh, how he suffered all and accomplished all.
Thank you,
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. That's great.